All right. Welcome in, everybody, to the Deep Dive. We've got a pretty weighty topic in front of us today. We're going to be diving into the idea of natural law.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those concepts, I think, that's really shaped how we think about morality, right? How
yeah.
we decide what's right and wrong, but also how we structure our laws
yeah.
and even political systems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the underlying code, you know, the
okay.
stuff that's been shaping our ideas about, well, good governance, justice, even just basic fairness for centuries upon centuries.
Yeah, for a really long time. And we've actually got this fascinating mix of sources for this deep dive.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking at natural law from both a philosophical perspective, how we use reason to make sense of it, but also through the lens of theology. So you can kind of see how different belief systems have approached this concept.
Right.
So really the mission here is, well, first, to really grasp what natural law actually means, where did this idea come from, and honestly, why is it still relevant today? Mm. I mean, this isn't some dusty old philosophical concept. It's still very much alive.
Mm, absolutely. I think one of the most interesting things that we're going to see is how these texts argue that we all have this capacity, just by using our own reasoning, to figure out certain fundamental moral guidelines.
Mm.
It's not like they're just handed down. You know, these aren't arbitrary rules. The idea is that they're somehow built into what it means to be human, to have this human nature.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, we're throwing around this term natural law, but for someone who might be hearing this for the first time or maybe just needs a little refresher, what's the most basic, like, core idea we should be keeping in mind?
Well, the way these texts explain it is natural law basically refers to these fundamental orientations for moral action, these directions, you know, like a compass almost. And the idea is that we can discern these directions, figure them out just by using our reason. It's not, you know, someone's opinion. It's something that's, well, it's thought to be in line with our nature, with our shared human nature. And then these fundamental understandings can be expressed as universal principles, kind of like commandments or precepts that guide how we should act.
So it's not just some theoretical idea that floats around in the ether somewhere.
Mm.
This actually has like real world impact, like on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. And the texts really stress that natural law plays this crucial role in both establishing and inspiring all sorts of norms, not just moral norms, but also legal and political norms. It's like this benchmark that we can constantly refer back to evaluate. Our laws just, you know, our political systems, do they respect human dignity? And it acts as this kind of protection against whatever the trends of the day might be, against ideologies that could potentially dehumanize.
Okay, so it's pretty foundational then, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so.
So is this something that's specific to, you know, a particular religion or a belief system? I mean, we talked about having theological texts here, but is it kind of like tied to that?
That's a really important question. And I think it's important to note that while Christianity has certainly embraced natural law and developed it in its own way, it doesn't have a monopoly on this concept. Our sources are very clear about that.
Okay.
The roots of natural law actually lie in reason. And reason is something that every human being, regardless of their beliefs, you know, regardless of their background, has access to.
Right.
And this shared foundation is what makes it so interesting, right? Because it's a potential meeting point, a basis for collaboration among people of goodwill.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this makes me think, this idea of like an innate sense of justice, or at least, mm-hmm. you know, an understanding of what's fair and right. This isn't exactly a new idea, right?
Yeah.
I feel like humans have been wrestling with this forever.
You're absolutely right. And that's why our sources take us all the way back to ancient Greece and Rome.
Okay.
Because these seeds were already planted there. Think about the story of Antigone from the Greek tragedy. She defies King Creon's order to bury her brother.
Right, right.
And she appeals to these, you know, quote, unwritten and immutable laws that she believes are higher than any human decree. This is a really powerful illustration of this early grasp of a kind of justice that transcends the laws that are written down by any particular government.
Right. So she felt bound by something higher. And, you know, I vaguely remember, I think, in college, studying about how the Greeks, they really were talking about different kinds of laws. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Absolutely. The Sophists, for example, made this distinction between laws that are just conventions.
Mm-hmm.
They called them theses, basically, you know, agreements, rules that societies just decide on.
Right.
And then there are these laws that exist, quote, by nature. Right. And they argued that these natural laws, these aren't dependent on time and place. These are universal. These apply to everyone everywhere. But, I mean, there were some pretty, you know, controversial interpretations. A sophist named Callicles, for example, well, he took it in a pretty dark direction. He basically said, look, natural law, it's just might makes right. The strongest should just get what they want.
That doesn't sound very moral at all.
No, not at all. And it raises this really, you know, crucial question that we're still dealing with today. I mean, how do we define what's natural in a way that's actually ethical, that doesn't just end up justifying, you know, any kind of power grab?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is where, you know, the big guns come in. Plato and Aristotle, they step in and they really, you know, push back against this might makes right view. They agree that there are different kinds of justice, but they say, look, natural justice, this isn't about brute force. It's actually this standard, this measuring stick that we can use to judge the laws that we make, to make sure they're actually just, that they're aligned with the nature of things, you know, with the nature of reality and the nature of what it means to be human and to flourish.
Right. So they're saying when we get it right, those laws that we create, those are actually reflecting this deeper natural justice.
Exactly. They're like an application of it, an expression of it in the social realm.
Okay, so that makes sense. So we've got this idea, there is such a thing as natural law, you know, and it's something that we can understand through reason just by using our minds. But is there like one core idea, like it's a central principle that everything else builds on?
Yes, definitely. And the sources are pretty consistent on this. The foundation, the very core of natural law, is what they call the primary precept. And it's really simple. It's this: one must do good and avoid evil.
Okay, that sounds pretty straightforward. But where does that even come from? I mean, how do we know that? How is that like hardwired? If it is.
Right. And that's the interesting part. The argument is that this principle, this primary precept, it's something that we grasp naturally immediately through what's called practical reason. It's kind of like, think about the principle of non-contradiction, the idea that something can't be both true and false at the same time.
Right.
You know, that's just like basic logic. We just get it. And this moral principle, this do good, avoid evil, it's similar. It's just this fundamental way that our minds work when we're thinking about action. And there's even a traditional term for this. It's called synderesis, which refers to this innate intellectual disposition, this kind of starting point for moral understanding.
Synderesis. I like that word. It's very...
It's got a ring to it. Yeah.
Yeah. So is it kind of like, are we saying this is like an innate moral compass that we're all born with? This like synderesis?
You could think about it that way, yeah? It's like a basic intuition, a deep down feeling that something's wrong, even if maybe we can't fully articulate why yet.
Right, right. Okay.
And the sources go on to say that recognizing moral laws isn't just like an abstract mental exercise. It's not just, you know, up in your head. It's actually described as this direct perception of these fundamental moral goods. And it comes from this kind of deep connection, what they call a connaturality of the spirit with values. So it's involving not just our intellect, but also our emotions, our whole being. It's like we're naturally drawn to what's good. We have this sense of it.
So it's about paying attention to those natural inclinations, what we're kind of pulled towards, what we naturally value.
Yes, exactly. And it's important to distinguish this from just like fleeting desires or whims, right?
Right.
But those deeper inclinations, those more fundamental desires, when you reflect on those, you can see that the things we value, they're actually essential for us to thrive, for us to flourish as human beings. And from this reflection, from this understanding of ourselves and what we need to be truly happy, we can start to formulate these more general principles, these universal duties that are kind of like the blueprints for moral action.
Okay.
And these shared principles that stem from our common human nature, this is what constitutes natural law.
Okay, I'm following you.
So yeah.
These natural law principles, are they all like equally specific?
That's a great question.
And are they all on the same level?
And actually, the sources make a really important distinction between what they call primary and secondary precepts.
Okay.
So the primary precepts, these are the general, almost self-evident principles that we just, you know, grasp immediately, like that core one, do good, avoid evil.
Okay, got it.
But then there are secondary precepts. These are more concrete guidelines that we kind of discover through reasoning, through more, you know, careful thinking, and also through life experience. You have to live, you have to experience the world to really flesh these out.
Right, right. So we're applying these principles to, you know, different situations, different contexts.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
And to understand these more concrete moral goods, it requires really thinking about what truly fulfills individuals, what makes for a good and flourishing human community.
So, you know, like you said, do good, avoid evil. That's primary.
Right.
But a secondary precept could be like respect your elders.
Right, exactly.
That's more specific.
A more concrete application.
No, okay, I get it. So we've got these sort of fundamental principles, maybe these unchanging truths, and then we have these more specific guidelines that, you know, they might evolve as we learn more as a society.
Yeah.
So this brings up the question, is natural law itself, is it truly universal? Like, does it apply to everyone everywhere, and is it unchanging? Does it stay the same over time?
That's really the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, based on the sources, the answer is, well, kind of yes and no. So the general formulation of these natural law principles, you know, the basic ideas and the fundamental values that they point to, these are considered universal. They apply to all of humanity.
Okay.
And the reason they're unchanging, they have this immutability, is because they're rooted in the very essence of what it means to be human, which is something that, well, it doesn't really change throughout history.
Okay.
But, and this is a really, really important but, these principles, they're not always perfectly clear to everyone.
Right.
They can get obscured, you know, they can get distorted due to all sorts of things like wrongdoing, like negative cultural influences, like harmful ideologies. We have to remember that we're not always perfectly rational beings.
Right.
Our thinking can be clouded by all sorts of, you know, biases and, I don't know, just stuff that gets in the way. And then there's this widespread idea, this kind of relativism, that everything is just like relative, that there's no objective truth.
Yeah.
And then there are what are called structures of sin. These are like societal patterns that make it harder to do good and to see clearly.
So you're saying we can't just assume that natural law is just going to be like self-evident to everybody.
Exactly. I think we have to be careful about assuming that because the reality is much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
However, that being said, there's still this potential for these principles to serve as this foundation for ethical dialogue, for conversations that can bridge different cultures, different beliefs, and I think that's incredibly powerful. But it requires a real willingness to listen, to try to understand the needs of others, and to look for those shared values that connect us.
Yeah, so you can't just like throw the rule book at somebody.
Right.
There has to be like a willingness to have that back and forth.
Absolutely. And I think in today's world, I mean, think about how diverse our societies are, this kind of dialogue. It's more important than ever.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've talked about the principles, but it sounds like just knowing the rules isn't enough. Yeah. It seems like our internal character, like our moral habits, these play a huge role too.
You're hitting on something really important here. And the sources, they definitely emphasize this idea that to truly grasp natural law and to live it out, we need more than just intellectual knowledge.
Okay.
We need these internal dispositions, these virtues that allow us to actually make good judgments and to act in accordance with what's right.
So things like courage, honesty, justice, you know, those kinds of things.
Exactly. And there's been this real resurgence of what's called virtue ethics, which focuses on developing these good character traits, these moral habits that allow us to flourish as human beings. Think about the idea of the wise man, you know, that archetype that you find across different cultures. This is someone who's cultivated these virtues, who's developed this moral wisdom. And as a result, they have this discernment, this ability to see what the right course of action is and to actually live it out.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's switch gears a little bit here. You know, we've been talking about philosophy and ethics, but we've also got these theological texts. So where does God fit into all of this? Is this just a totally separate thing? You know, natural laws over here and faith and religion are over there. Or is there more to it?
Well, the sources actually paint a pretty interesting picture of how these things are connected.
Okay.
So from a theological perspective, natural law is seen as humanity's way of participating in what's called the eternal law, which is, you know, essentially God's plan. It's the grand design, if you will. And this participation, it happens on two main levels. First, through our natural inclinations, which are seen as these kind of built-in expressions of God's wisdom. It's like these little hints that are embedded in our very being. And second, through human reason itself, which is seen as a reflection of God's own intelligence. It's like we're given this gift of reason to understand the world, including this moral order that's built into it.
So it's like we're co-creating with the divine designer in a way, when we use our reason to figure out these natural laws.
Exactly, yeah. And that leads to this idea called participated theonomy, where our ethical choices involve freely aligning ourselves with this divine law, this eternal law, that's also accessible to us through our reason.
Hmm. So it's like this beautiful tapestry where human freedom and divine will are interwoven.
Exactly. And that's really the traditional view, this idea of harmony between humanity, nature, and the divine.
Right.
But the texts also point out that this view has actually shifted over time. Things haven't always been seen this way.
What do you mean? What changed?
Well, there was this time, you know, especially with the rise of modern thought, where things started to fragment a bit, you know, changes in philosophical thinking, like this move towards nominalism, which basically said that, you know, general concepts like goodness or justice, these are just names. They don't actually refer to real things. Mm. And there were also changes in how we understand human nature. There was a big emphasis on like voluntarism and individual freedom, you know, like I decide what's good for me.
Right.
And this all led to this sense of separation between humanity and the natural world.
So instead of seeing ourselves as part of this harmonious whole, people started to see themselves as like distinct from nature or even in opposition to it.
Right. And there was this idea that humans are almost like denatured animals, you know, we're somehow different.
Mm-hmm.
We define ourselves by going against nature, by imposing our will on it. And culture, you know, all of human creation was no longer seen as a way to perfect nature, but rather as something that negates it, that replaces it.
So nature gets demoted to just like this inert, meaningless stuff that's there for us to exploit.
Right, exactly. And that led to this kind of threefold split between nature, human subjectivity, and God. Nature gets reduced to just matter, just stuff that's governed by deterministic laws, by physics and chemistry, and it loses that sense of being a source of wisdom, of having an ethical message for us.
Yeah, and that makes sense. It's kind of a slippery slope, isn't it? If we see ourselves as separate, where do our values even come from? Like, what grounds them?
That's exactly the problem. While this shift might seem like it's all about human freedom, right? By cutting us off from nature, it actually undermines the very foundation of freedom. Because if there are no objective norms, if there's no like moral compass that's built into reality, then our values become totally arbitrary. You know, we can just make up whatever we want. And that can lead to all sorts of problems, including potentially nihilism, the belief that, you know, everything is ultimately meaningless.
So how do we get back to that sense of connection, that sense of a unified whole? You know, how do we bridge this gap between humanity and nature and the divine?
Well, the sources suggest that we need a kind of, I don't know, like a homecoming. We need to return to this perspective of wisdom, a way of seeing the world that's rooted in understanding the nature of reality, what philosophers call metaphysics. This means, you know, going beyond just looking at things in a fragmented, isolated way. It's about seeing how everything fits together, how everything participates in this larger whole. And this includes understanding that we fulfill ourselves not by trying to oppose nature, but by freely participating in God's plan, by aligning ourselves with this deeper order.
Okay, so it's about rediscovering that moral wisdom that might be embedded in nature itself.
Yes, and that requires a philosophy of nature that recognizes what the sources call the intelligible depth of the sensible world, meaning that there's this inherent meaning and purpose in the natural world. It's not just stuff. It's the work of a divine logos. And we can understand this through our reason, through our ability to see those patterns and connections. But it's important to avoid just equating ethics with the physical world, right? It's not about just looking at animal behavior and saying, oh, that's how we should act.
Right, right.
It's about integrating our natural inclinations, those deeper desires that we've been talking about, within the wholeness of the human person. We have to use our reason to guide those inclinations and to direct them towards their proper end, towards our spiritual fulfillment. Like, for example, in truly committed loving relationships, we see how those natural inclinations, when guided by reason and love, can lead to something so much greater, so much more fulfilling.
Okay, that's beautiful. So let's shift gears just a little bit here and talk about how natural law relates to the way we organize ourselves as societies, you know, like politically.
Yeah.
How does that all play out?
Yeah, absolutely. When we move from, you know, just thinking about individual morality to the broader social and political realm, well, now we're dealing with the norms and laws that govern how we interact with each other. And it's here that we see a little bit of a distinction between natural law itself, those fundamental principles, and what the sources refer to as the norm of natural justice.
Okay, I'm curious, how do those two things differ when we're talking about, you know, how we set up our societies.
So think of it this way. Natural law, those are like the blueprints. Those are the underlying moral truths about human nature that should guide everything.
Okay.
Natural justice is more about the specific standards for right relationships among people, how we live together in community.
Got it.
And the sources really stress this point. The human person is at the very center of any just political and social order. Individuals, they're not just cogs in a machine. They're not means to an end. They are the end. We are naturally social creatures. We need relationships to flourish. And we're embedded in these different social circles, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have the family, you have your work, you have your community, your nation, and ultimately all of humanity. And we have this reciprocal relationship with those circles, right?
Yeah, we give and take.
We benefit from them, and we have a responsibility to contribute to their well-being.
So would you say that natural law acts as kind of this guide, this set of principles for how we structure those societies, those political systems?
Exactly. Natural law is like the normative horizon. It provides that framework, that ethical grounding for a just political order. And it does this by defining these core values, these universal humanizing values that allow people to truly flourish. And it's important to emphasize that in the social and political realm, we can't just appeal to personal preferences or ideologies.
Right.
These values have to be rooted in this shared human nature that we've been talking about. They have to apply to everyone.
Yeah, makes sense.
And the primary goal of any society then is to serve the well-being of each person, to create the conditions that allow each individual to realize their full potential. And that means that the individual is prior to the state. The state exists to serve the person, not the other way around.
That's a good reminder. The text actually mentioned four key values that flow from these natural inclinations and that should shape what we call the common good of society. Can you remind us what those are?
Oh, absolutely. So you have freedom, truth, justice, and solidarity. Freedom, of course, is essential. You know, individuals need to be able to act freely, including freedom of conscience, to pursue what they believe is true and good. Without freedom, you don't have a humane society. Then there's truth. You know, if a society isn't grounded in truth, it becomes easy to manipulate people, to control them. Justice, of course, is paramount. This is about fairness, about ensuring that everyone gets what they deserve, that rights are respected. And then you have solidarity, which emphasizes our interconnectedness, our mutual responsibility for one another. It's about caring for the most vulnerable, working together for the common good. The absence of any one of these values can lead to some pretty serious problems, you know, to injustice, to oppression, even to violence.
Yeah, I can see that. And these fundamental values, do they then get translated into more concrete rights that we should all have?
Yes, exactly. The norms of natural justice, remember, these are the standards for right relationships, for what's fair and just in how we treat each other. And these norms are often expressed as fundamental human rights, like the right to life, the right to bodily integrity, you know, freedom from violence, religious freedom, freedom of thought and expression, the right to form a family, freedom of association, the right to participate in the political process. And these rights, they're not based on, you know, whatever's trendy or whatever a particular government decides.
Right.
They're rooted in the very nature of what it means to be human and the kinds of relationships that allow us to flourish.
So natural law provides this kind of foundation for human rights that doesn't depend on, you know, any specific culture or government or historical period.
Precisely. And it's really the subjective sense of justice that's grounded in those unchanging truths of natural law.
Okay, so that's really powerful. So, you know, you've mentioned this before, but I think it's worth emphasizing again, natural law, it's not based on faith, it's based on reason.
Right. It appeals to our shared capacity for rational thought.
Right. So everyone, regardless of their religious beliefs, can participate in this conversation.
Exactly. And while our reasoning can sometimes be flawed, you know, we all have biases, we all make mistakes.
Sure.
The constant reference to natural law, it encourages us to keep refining our thinking, to keep striving for greater clarity, you know, to purify our reason so that we don't get swept away by prejudice or self-interest or, you know, political manipulation.
Right. So it's like this ongoing process of trying to see more clearly.
Yes, exactly. And in the political realm, natural law acts as a kind of limit on the power of the state.
Okay.
You know, it prevents the state from becoming all powerful. It supports a system where the government is accountable to the law, where it respects the principle of subsidiarity, which means, you know, letting local communities handle their own affairs as much as possible.
Right, right.
And ultimately, natural law upholds the dignity of individuals and of those smaller communities within the larger society. And the sources even suggest that acknowledging a higher power, a god of love, can actually help us to see through those harmful political ideologies, you know, those myths that try to justify injustice.
Mm. Yeah, because it kind of gives us a different standard to measure things against.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we're in the home stretch here.
Yeah.
The last part of our source is it delves into Jesus Christ and how he relates to natural law. How does that all fit in? I mean, it's kind of a jump, isn't it? From ancient Greek philosophers to Jesus.
Well, it might seem like a jump, but it's actually a really profound connection.
Okay.
So the sources explain that human reason, by participating in what they call the divine light, it allows us to understand this inherent order of the universe and to act morally within it, you know, to make choices that are in line with that deeper truth.
Okay.
And from a Christian perspective, the world was created by, through, and for the Logos, which is Christ, in whom everything finds its meaning and coherence. So it's like this, everything points back to Christ. Everything participates in this divine reality. And the human person created in God's image, well, we bear that imprint of the Logos, and we have this fundamental calling to become more and more like Christ.
So it's like within the Christian worldview, there's this deep connection between natural law and this idea of like becoming more Christ-like.
Exactly.
Okay, so how do Jesus's teachings specifically connect with those natural law principles that we've been talking about?
So Jesus really emphasizes the central importance of charity, which is love of God and love of neighbor, as this new commandment that summarizes and fulfills the whole law. You know, it's like he takes everything that came before and says, this is the heart of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And charity, it takes the golden rule, that idea of, you know, treating others as you want to be treated. It takes it to a whole new level.
Okay.
It's not just about avoiding harm. It's about actively loving, about giving of oneself, like we see in the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Right. So you're not just like staying out of people's way. You're actually going out of your way to help them.
Exactly. And then the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, they further spell out, you know, how to live out this commandment of love, you know, with generosity, with mercy, with a real concern for the well-being of others, especially the most vulnerable.
Okay, so it's like taking those basic principles of natural law and infusing them with this, like, radical self-giving love.
Exactly. And the sources explain that the Holy Spirit, which Christians believe is received through Christ's sacrifice and resurrection, it actually empowers believers to act according to this law of love. It becomes this internal principle, this driving force within us. And the grace of the Holy Spirit is seen as the heart of the new law, or the law of the gospel, which leads to this personal transformation, this growth in holiness and love.
Okay, so there's this like inner transformation that happens that allows us to live out this higher law.
Exactly. And this inner law of freedom, you know, being guided by love, it actually fulfills our deepest desire for true autonomy. Because it's not autonomy in the sense of just doing whatever we want. Yeah. It's autonomy in the sense of being free from those things that enslave us, you know, free from selfishness. Free from fear.
Right. It's like a deeper freedom.
Exactly. It's a freedom that comes from being united with God and being empowered by the Holy Spirit.
And then, you know, the last thing our sources touch on, it's the role of ontology.
Right.
And this is like, you know, for me, it's heady stuff. It's like the study of being, the nature of existence.
Okay.
So how does understanding that, like, how does that even help us wrap our minds around natural law?
Well, ontology might seem a little abstract, but it actually provides this really crucial framework for understanding reality, including the divine. You know, it helps us answer those big questions like, why is there something rather than nothing? What does it mean for something to exist? And in a religious context, it helps clarify concepts like divine causality, like how does God act in the world? It suggests that certain events, like the emergence of humanity, you know, the very fact that we exist, can't be explained just by chance or by purely material processes. These point to a deeper, a divine purpose, a creative intelligence behind it all. And ontology is this like key area where philosophy and religious thought intersect, because it's all about understanding the nature of being, which is essential if we're going to talk about God and creation and how those things relate to each other. And in Christian theology, there's this big emphasis on the ontological significance of reason. You know, Christians believe in a rational universe created by a rational God. And this supports the idea that we can, through our reason, come to understand these these fundamental truths, including moral truths like those that are found in natural law. And the sources kind of caution against neglecting ontology.
Okay.
Because if we lose sight of those big questions about being and existence, it can lead to a disconnect from, you know, traditional understandings of God and creation. And it can actually weaken our confidence in the idea that there's a rational God, that there's this intelligent design behind the universe, which ultimately underpins the whole idea of natural law from a religious perspective.
So it's almost like if we don't grapple with those,